It appears that, at least for now, the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac crisis has been contained. So we asked NPR's Adam Davidson to look at what could have been. That's if the U.S. government had not stepped in and rescued the mortgage giants.
I don't think most people realize just how huge Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are. Their combined debt is $5 trillion. That's a lot. That's almost certainly the most debt any private company has ever had in history. Actually, forget private companies. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's debt is larger than any country in history, other than, of course, one country, the United States. If Japan's economy collapsed completely, if the whole United Kingdom went bankrupt, that would likely have less of an impact on the global economy than Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac going under.
The bankruptcy of Fannie and Freddie would have made Armageddon, would have made...
What do you mean Armageddon?
A meltdown of the financial system.
The global financial.
Yeah, of the global financial system.
That's Domenico Siniscalco, former finance minister of Italy. Would it have been that bad? I turned to the man standing next to Siniscalco and asked him what would happen if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac defaulted on their debt.
Oh, well, it would be credit markets would seize.
This, by the way, is Tim Adams, former Treasury Undersecretary. He is not someone who goes for the dramatic overstatement. He said that so many banks around the world own Fannie and Freddie bonds. If those bonds were suddenly worth much less, the banks would stop giving out loans of any kind. I'm not just talking about mortgages, all kinds of borrowing.
And if you can't borrow, you can't run your business, you can't go to school, you can't run a university, you can't expand, and therefore the economy stops.
The economy stops.
We are built on credit, and that's what runs the economy. Without access to credit, the economy seizes. I mean, it just stops.
I asked Adams if he's saying things would get as bad as the Great Depression, or worse.
It would certainly be the event of our lifetime, and probably be felt for a very long period of time.
Decades.
At least, yes.
So by coincidence, there's a conference this week at UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. It's a conference of former finance ministers from India, Australia, Korea, Iraq, Canada, Kuwait, and others. I grabbed as many of those ministers as I could in the hallway between sessions, and this is what I learned. They all agree that Henry Paulson had no choice. He had to step in on Sunday. But they all agreed on something else, that the U.S. reputation has taken a rough hit. Australia's former finance minister, Peter Costello.
For such a long period of time, the U.S. was a force for stability in global markets. Here is an example of the U.S. actually exporting instability.
Costello says international investors will be more wary about investing in the U.S. That means, well, it means less money coming to America, fewer new factories, lower paying jobs. No one knows how much or how long, but there will be an impact. There's something else these guys, and they were all guys, hinted at, that the U.S. has lost a bit of its persuasive power. Some are actually pretty happy about that.
It's good. It's a good week for India.
It's a good week for India, says Yashwant Sinha. He had a big smile when he said it. He said for years, the U.S. and others came to India for consultations and told him the country's financial system is too backwards, it's primitive, it's closed off from global finance.
Every consultation told us we were not managing our affairs properly. And now everyone is looking at India as an example of cautious management of the economy and cautious opening up.
Sinha's pride in India's economic policy, that has got to drive the U.S. Treasury Department crazy. India's closed-off approach is the opposite of what the U.S. government, Democrats and Republicans, have been pushing for. And now he's all cocky about it? Look, everyone at this conference says the U.S. is, of course, without question, the dominant economy in the world. It's a place lots of people all over the world will invest in. But the U.S. doesn't look quite as dominant, quite as imposing as it did just a few months ago. Adam Davidson, NPR News, Charlottesville, Virginia.
And you can find extended interviews with these finance ministers, plus a primer on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, at NPR's new Planet Money blog, npr.org/money.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The House and Senate are back after a five-week break, and they're back at it. Both chambers are squabbling over how to bring down energy prices. House Democrats announced today that they'll roll out new energy legislation later this week, but they were short on specifics. And there is growing concern that an impasse over offshore oil drilling could lead to a government shutdown by the end of the month. NPR's David Wellner reports.
Republicans calling for more oil drilling held ad hoc sessions throughout the August recess in a darkened House chamber watched only by the tourists inside. Today, those Republicans had both lights and TV cameras trained on them, and they continued to demand an up or down vote on lifting a 26-year moratorium on drilling the United States' outer continental shelf. Indiana's Mike Pence appealed directly to the chamber's top Democrat.
Speaker Pelosi, respectfully, you could turn off the lights on the House floor, you could shut off the microphones, but you cannot silence the majority of the American people that want a comprehensive bill and want to drill here, drill more, drill now.
A short time later, Pelosi told reporters at the Capitol that she, too, was all for a comprehensive energy bill, just not the kind her GOP colleagues are seeking.
Republicans must set aside their drill only. Even their own supporters have said we cannot drill ourselves out of this emergency situation. And it will come down to this. It will come down to this when it comes to energy. Whose side are you on? The side of the American consumer and the taxpayer, or big oil?
Pelosi said House Democrats do want to expand domestic energy production, as well as foment alternative energy supplies and protect consumers. But she said the energy bill her party intends to bring to the floor this week for a vote remains a work in progress. Pelosi was vague when asked just where the Democrats might allow more domestic oil drilling.
We are working with our colleagues on that subject right now in terms of where. But certainly, at least where the Senate language that you have seen in the southeast, and we'll see beyond that.
The Senate language the House Speaker referred to was put forward by a bipartisan group calling itself the Gang of Ten early last month. It would allow Virginia, the Carolinas, and Georgia to decide whether to permit oil drilling more than 50 miles from their Atlantic shores. But Republicans want all offshore drilling restrictions lifted. And today, Roy Blunt, the number two House Republican, indicated he may recommend that President Bush veto an annual stopgap spending bill if it contains a renewal of the drilling moratorium. That brought a sharp response from Rahm Emanuel, a member of the House Democratic leadership.
If Mr. Blunt's recommendation to the president is for a veto to force that, he'd be the author of the shutdown of the government.
Still, Republicans today appeared dead set against allowing any extension in a big spending bill of the drilling moratorium. Here's the Senate's number two Republican, John Kyle.
One of the things that somebody's going to try to do is attach a rider to that appropriation bill, maybe in the middle of the night, I don't know, but it's going to be to continue a moratorium on offshore drilling. Mark my words, somebody's going to try to do that. We cannot allow that to happen.
Democrats hope the drilling measures they've proposed will be enough to get Republicans to back down. As Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid pointed out, the GOP was behind the last government shutdown in 1995.
I would hope that some of those people have read very recent history where Gingrich tried to do that and it didn't work out well for the Republicans and certainly didn't work out well for this country.
The Senate plans to take up energy legislation next week. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. The repercussions continue from the government's historic takeover of the nation's two largest mortgage companies. In a moment, we'll ask the chairman of the Senate's Banking Committee what's ahead for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. First, NPR's Chris Arnold reports on how interest rates have gone down suddenly and sharply.
Mortgage brokers around the country yesterday were glued to their computer monitors, watching to see what the government takeover would mean for interest rates.
We're starting to see some changes right now, so it seems to be a trend, and everyone seems to be repricing right now.
Paul Van Wert is a broker with Allied Home Mortgage in Westwood, Massachusetts. Just last Friday, he could offer customers with good credit a 30-year fixed-rate loan for 6.25%.
Today, we've had our second rate change. We're actually down about to 5.75 right now at this point.
That's a huge move in just one day of business. Basically, because of the Fannie Freddie takeover, investors were suddenly willing to pay more to buy up U.S. home loans, and that drives down interest rates. Van Wert gets a phone call alerting him to how quickly rates are changing.
Here's what's happening. Folks, mortgage mortgage-backed securities are going crazy. They are now up 147 basis points.
The problem has been that Fannie and Freddie took too many risks and got into trouble with mortgages that went bad. And investors as far away as China have been worried about exactly what would happen if Fannie and Freddie failed. The mortgage giants back three-quarters of new home loans being made in the U.S. But now the government stepped in and put itself in charge of that crucial role that the companies play. That's provided a lot of clarity. And yesterday, the market responded.
If you're seeing rates under 6% right now, back into the fives, these are 2005 interest rates suddenly are rearing their head here. So this is definitely a great, great sign. And it's a good thing for realtors, for home buyers, sellers, people looking to refinance, people looking to buy a second home.
Some economists are optimistic, too. William Wheaton is with MIT's Center for Real Estate.
Well, first of all, I think this is good, good, good.
Wheaton says he expects interest rates to fall even further in coming months. He's hopeful that'll get more people buying homes. Also, Wheaton thinks Fannie and Freddie were having trouble backing as many loans as they needed to because they couldn't raise enough money from investors.
There was a lot of rumor that in the last 2 months, they were doing very, very little business, that they had really started to restrict their flows. And I think that's what the Treasury Secretary is following, that data very, very carefully. And I think that's probably why they stepped in.
Basically, the housing market's bad enough already. Nobody wants qualified borrowers with good jobs unable to get loans. So some analysts say the Fannie-Freddie takeover plugged a serious hole in the dam, but
we still have lots of problems.
Mark Zandi is an economist who's been following the financial crisis and who's written a book about it.
The job market's still a mess. We still got inventory. We still got prices declining. The financial system probably has more shoes to fall. So this isn't over, but I think this marks the beginning of the end of this very painful financial crisis.
Meanwhile, there are still a lot of questions and concerns over the regulatory lapses that allowed the situation to get this bad to where the government has had to take charge of the two largest companies at the heart of the U.S. mortgage market. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
The federal takeover of Fannie and Freddie includes an edict that they must stop lobbying. But if you've followed the two corporations over the years, you know that's like telling them to stop breathing. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
The first directives went out yesterday from corporate headquarters by email. One of them, obtained by NPR, was sent around 12:30 p.m. It basically told lobbyists to stay put for now and watch out what they say. Just a few sentences, but it could be writing the final chapter in a great saga of Washington lobbying. Fannie and Freddie's lobbying has inspired awe and envy and won whopping fine from the Federal Election Commission in 2005.
Well, the main thing was they had the resources. I mean, it was the sheer numbers as much as anything.
That's lawyer Mike House. He worked with FM Policy Focus, an industry group that argued for years that Fannie and Freddie needed stronger oversight. The resources that Mike House refers to, a combined total of more than $174 million over the past decade. That put Fannie and Freddie in the top 20 for lobbying dollars for that period, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. And another thing about Freddie and Fannie, says Mike House.
They were very strategically focused.
That meant campaign money for the right people, many Democrats and even more Republicans in the House and Senate. The campaign cash cracked the $10 million mark a while ago. In 2005, when Freddie Mac paid the Federal Election Commission a record fine of $3.8 million, the institution had set up 85 fundraisers, mainly for members of the key House Committee on Financial Services. Freddie's head lobbyist at the time called the events, quote, political risk management. Strategic focus also extended to hiring. The companies have been famous for hiring big political names. The long list includes former Clinton budget director Franklin Raines, Democratic operative Harold Ickes, as well as Republican lobbyist and fundraiser Wayne Berman and former Republican Congresswoman Susan Molinari. And then there's the not-quite-lobbying activity, Freddie and Fannie's grassroots efforts to burnish their reputations. In the housing boom a few years ago, they both went on TV with ads like this one.
Here, there's a nice Cape Cod, three bedrooms, two baths.
All across our country, families are able to find their own path to the American dream because companies like Fannie Mae and its partners...
Mike House says Fannie and Freddie's new status should be clarified.
The Treasury Department and Fannie and Freddie will actually speak for themselves now. They won't be lobbyists doing this, but it'll be the officers of the company and the Treasury Department.
But the administration isn't saying that Fannie and Freddie will stay under government control. That raises the question of whether they could revive their lobbying operations again in a few years. Anne Lee doesn't think so. She's a professor of finance at Pace University in New York.
Once the government absorbs this, it's really hard to offload it again.
And if that's the case, Washington has just seen the abrupt end of two titans of lobbying. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.